231. That's the average number of apps used by many companies. This leads to a lot of context and tab switching that drains employee focus and costs your company. Grammarly can help. Grammarly's AI works in over 500,000 apps and websites, making it easy for your team to write clearly and on brand without disrupting workflow. Join 70,000 teams who save an average of $5,000 per employee per year using Grammarly. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more.
Chapter 7 of The House by the Lock by Mrs. C. N. Williamson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 7. Friends. It was all I could do to resist the impulse to take the small trembling hands in my own, to touch the bowed head with its glory of shimmering ripples, to break into passionate words which must have alarmed her, and put an end to my chance of winning her, perhaps for ever. But to a certain extent I was able to control myself. "What can I say? What can I do?" I stammered. "If there was only some way in which it might be possible for me to help you." "Ah, if!" she echoed desolately. "Don't you think it strange that, though we scarcely know each other, though this is only our second meeting, and quite by chance, I turn to you with such a confession? I am ashamed now." And she impetuously dashed her tears away with a toy of a handkerchief. But the words spoke themselves before I could stop them. You see, I have no one to talk to, no one to advise me. I think I must be the loneliest girl in all this big, preoccupied world. "I should have thought you would have had more friends than you could keep within bounds," I said hotly. "Friends? Has anyone many friends? I have plenty of acquaintances, but I think no friends. Let us not talk of this any more, though, Mr. Stanton. I have forgotten myself." "Forgive me. I can't obey you," I protested. "Just one word. As you said, this is only our second meeting, and I have no right to ask a favor of you, yet I am going to do it. I beg of you, as I never begged anything before, that you will forget how short a time we have known each other, and that you will take me for a friend in the truest and best sense of that good, much-abused word. I swear to you that you would find me loyal." She looked up at me in the sweetest way, with eyes that glistened through a sheen of tears. "I believe that I should find you so," she answered falteringly. "And, oh, how I do need a friend, though you may think me disloyal to say that, when I have a home and those who have meant to be kind to me." Her eyes had dropped, but now she raised them again and met mine earnestly. "Yes," she exclaimed, "yes, I will have you for a friend." "Then won't you begin by making use of me at once?" I pleaded with an eagerness I could no longer disguise. "Am I not making use of you now?" "Ah, I know what you mean. You mean I am to tell you the things which I have let you see are troubling me? But much as I need help and advice, could I do that now, so soon? You must already think me a very strange girl, half mad, perhaps. Well, I have had almost enough of late to drive me mad. Sometime, in a few days maybe, when we know each other a little better, But the man is stopping. We have come to the doctor's you spoke of, I suppose?" I neither blessed the cabman nor the doctor at that moment. Still less did I do so afterwards, knowing that, if we had not been interrupted then, it might well have happened that the whole course of our two lives had been changed. However, there was nothing to be done but ascertain if the eminent man was at home and able to give his attention to a somewhat urgent case. The poor girl, too, was evidently suffering, and in a highly nervous state, and it would have been cruel, now that the opportunity had presented itself, to keep her for a single instant from the restoratives doubtless at hand. Dr. Burns was to be seen. I introduced Miss Cunningham to him, described the accident, and left him to do what he could for the injured ankle. Afterwards, I had still the joy of driving to Park Lane with her in anticipation. I was only called when Dr. Burns was ready to send his patient away. Do you know what was the first thing that this young lady did before I had time to begin my ministrations? He jocularly inquired, and though the girl looked up at him with imploring eyes, he persisted. Why, she fainted away, and if she had to do it, she couldn't have chosen a more proper occasion. There I was, with all the known remedies at hand, and I proceeded to use them, with the most satisfactory results, as you may see. I don't think you will have any further trouble in going home. And now that she has been well dosed and well bandaged, the best thing she can do is to eat a hearty luncheon. Once again settled in the cab, we were but a few moments' drive from Sir Walter Tressidy's house in Park Lane, as I knew to my intense regret. With wily forethought, however, I suggested going somewhat out of our way to the establishment of a certain bicycle manufacturer and mender who would send for Miss Cunningham's machine and repair it before the accident it had met with could be conjectured by those not supposed to know. Try as I would, I could not induce her to continue the conversation which had been broken short. The brief interval that had passed since then had severed the threads of intense emotion which had for the moment united us, and she, evidently repenting her frankness, was visibly ill at ease. It was only at the door that her manner warmed a little towards me again. "Yes, I believe I am quite all right," she said in answer to a question. "I shall not even have a suspicion of a limp." She held out her hand to me, and did not try to draw it away, though I grasped it rather longer and more tightly than conventionality might have approved. "You will come, soon, to see Lady Tressidy and me?" she asked softly. "I thought of calling tomorrow afternoon. May I?" "I shall be glad, very glad. Never shall I forget your kindness to me today. Don't think me any more odd than you can help. Goodbye." Before I could begin to tell her how impossible it would be to think any save the most reverent thoughts of her, she was gone, and a cloud seemed suddenly to darken my sky. End of Chapter 7. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 8 of The House by the Lock by Mrs. C. N. Williamson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 8. An Announcement. I would have given a year of my life to know what was the trouble and anxiety which so wrought upon Karen Cunningham. She was young, and it might be that her youth and her sex caused her mentally to exaggerate what was in reality a trifle. Yet, even with my slight knowledge of her, I could not believe this to be the case. Many conjectures passed in review before me, but that which seemed to carry with it most weight of reason was the idea that her guardian and his wife were attempting to coerce her into some course which was distasteful to her. Naturally, the thought of an objectionable lover occurred to me, and made my blood run the faster through my veins. I could not forgive the unknown and possible for being a lover, even though he were to her an objectionable one. I longed for the next day to come that I might see the beautiful girl again, but scarcely in the same way that I had longed for it before. There could be no repetition of the half-confidences of today, the suggestions of friendship, what a mockery, the adorable glances which meant trust and a gratitude which I had not deserved. Lady Tressidy would unfortunately be present. My visit would ostensibly be paid to her. Already I began to dislike her and fancy that her conduct towards the young girl entrusted to her care must have been mysteriously atrocious. No, I could not expect much from the call, having been blessed with an unexpected glimpse of heaven, which it could not give back to me again. Still, I thought of little else until the coming of the very earliest hour at which I could show myself in Park Lane on the following day. Yes, Lady Tressidy was at home, vouchsafed a solemn footman. My name was announced, and I scarcely ventured to lift my eyes on entering the drawing-room, lest they should tell me that Karen was not there. Perhaps she was ill. Indeed, it seemed only too likely that she should be so. I wondered I had not mentally confronted that probability before. There were a number of guests assembled in the room, it seemed to me, despite the fact that everybody who was anybody was supposed to be spending the Christmas season far away in other people's country houses. At length, when I had had a few words with my hostess, the crowd resolved itself into a dozen persons at most, and seeing Karen at a far end of the room, surrounded by three or four vacuous-looking young men, I desperately resolved to outstay everybody. I had scarcely more than a glance and a smile from Miss Cunningham, and then I found myself obliged to talk with simulated amiability to a semi-young woman who was anxious I should know how often she had heard of me and my travels, and that she had read the two or three books I had been idiot enough to write. Half an hour went by. I had been passed on to other ladies, who seemed to my prejudiced eyes to bear an astonishing family likeness, both in mind and face, to the first of the series. Three or four people had gone. One or two new ones had come in, but at last I had had the good fortune to escape from the latest on my list of acquaintances. I could still see Karen. She had got rid of one of her adorers, but had a couple yet in hand, and it appeared to me that she would not be sorry to bid them adieu. At all events, her face was pale as a lily petal held against the light, her sweet lips drooped wistfully at the corners, and I thought she spoke but seldom. The smile with which she had greeted me had been fleeting, and even as it lingered there had been an expression in her large soft eyes which it galled me that I should be too dull to read. It had seemed to say, "Something has happened since I saw you last. Why did you offer me your friendship when it was too late to give me any help?" No doubt, I told myself, this was but a morbid fancy of mine. If I could have known the true motive of the glance, I should have interpreted what appeared like unutterable sadness as mere boredom. Instead of the earnest approach or reproach, I imagined at most the eyes intended to say, "I have talked long enough with these stupid men, none of whom have minds above cricket or football. Relieve me of them, please." But I had not even been able to do that, though I had tried, for as I attempted to oust the boldest of the group in my own favor, Lady Tressidy had swept across the room, with sharp rustling of silken linings and satin skirts, to claim me for an introduction to an old friend who had longed for years to know me. At length, however, as I said, I had contrived an escape, and was finding my way towards Karen, when, before I had reached her, I saw her start, staring past me, with a white, frozen look on her face, that for the moment blotted out much of its innocent youthfulness and beauty. She was gazing in the direction of the door, with dark, dilated eyes, and lips tightly closed in a line of scarlet that faded to palest pink. It was as though into the midst of the gossip and laughter and brilliant light had crept a spectre which she alone could see. Some such look I had seen in the eyes of a dove, which had been offered up as food for a constrictor. Involuntarily I turned and glanced behind me. No name had been announced, though I had heard the opening and closing of the door, and now, as I faced round in that direction, I saw that Sir Walter Tressidy and Carson Wildred had come in together. Evidently this was not Wildred's first entrance, for, like Sir Walter, He had neither hat nor stick. He moved forward by his companion's side with the unmistakably assured air of the friend of the house, and I instinctively understood that he had lunched with the Tressidys, and since that time had been closeted on some business of importance with his host. Unreasoningly, I hated him for his privileges. With more of reason, I hated him because I believed the look I had seen for a single instant on Karen Cunningham's face was connected with his presence. That look was gone now. When I removed my eyes from Wildred and turned again to her, her delicate, spiritual profile only was visible. Her head was graciously inclined towards the monocled youth who stood nearest her. She appeared no longer to see Wildred or Sir Walter Tressidy. I was determined that the former should not approach her, as he seemed inclined to do, if I could prevent it. I hurried to her accordingly, and shut her away from the room with a pair of broad shoulders, and with an air of monopolizing her which I should not have dared at any other time to assume. But was I not her friend? Had I not the right to protect her, if I could, from all that I believed to be distasteful to her? Presently the callow youths, whose claims I had hardly considered, seemed to melt away, and I was left alone with her. People were going, and it was getting late, no doubt, but I did not yet mean to follow their example. After all, despite my dismal presages, it did appear that I was to have her for at least a moment or two to myself. I had kept my word. I had outstayed them all but Carson Wildred. "Have you quite recovered from yesterday's accident?" I asked, glad to share even so insignificant a secret with her. "Yes, oh yes," she spoke hurriedly, and her eyes had moved to the distant group near the fireside, Lady Tressidy, Carson, and Sir Walter. "You haven't reconsidered your promise that I should be your friend?" She turned to me quickly, and her eyes brimmed with unshed tears. "So many things in my life, though it is not so very long as yet, have come to me too late. Even my friends, sometimes." Before I could beg her to tell me what she meant, Lady Tressidy had called her name, and she sprang up obediently. I followed suit, of course. "Come here, my dear girl. Mr. Stanton, this is quite a momentous day for us, and I can't resist the temptation to take you into our circle and our confidence," said the elder woman graciously. "It is just settled that this sweet adopted child of ours is to leave us, and at short notice, too. She and Mr. Wildred are going to be married." End of chapter 8. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 9 of The House by the Lock by Mrs. C. N. Williamson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 9. Too Late. Too late! The words that Karen had just spoken echoed in my ears like a knell of doom. For a few tremendous seconds that seemed endless, I stood paralyzed by Lady Tressidy's announcement, unable to speak. Then I turned and looked at Karen. Her eyes seemed to have been waiting for mine, and for an instant I held them with my gaze, until they fell and veiled the answer mine had asked, with long shadowy lashes. Never, I thought, as my thirsty eyes drank in the beauty that was not for me, could there have been another woman so wholly lovely, so altogether desirable. I could have fallen on my knees before her, to touch the hem of her dainty gown with my lips, and cry out my love and longing for her. But instead I was called upon to say something civil, and therefore hypocritical, to the newly engaged pair, and then, as soon as decency would permit my escape, to go out from her presence forever, and face the black loneliness of my darkened life. Only a few days had passed since first I had seen the beauty of her face, but already she dominated my every thought, and I knew that there was no hope of surcease from the aching pain of having lost her. Had I been obliged to stand by and see her give herself to any other man than Carson Wildred, it seemed to me that the blow would have been more bearable. But with my almost unreasoning aversion for and distrust of him, the thought of a marriage between these two was like the sacrifice of fair virgins to the foul, blood-dripping jaws of the mythical Minotaur. Slight as was our actual acquaintance, when measured by mere time, it appeared the maddest conceit on my part to believe for a moment that had I come earlier into her life, I might have made a difference. But, mad as it was, I did so believe. Some voice within me, which would not be stilled or brook contradiction, cried aloud that I might have won her love, that she might have been mine, that only some devilish tangle of circumstances had circumvented the fate which originally had meant that we two should be all in all to one another. It was perhaps the hardest task I had ever been forced to perform when, after that ominous pause, which doubtless seemed far more prolonged to me than to the others, I held out my hand, as I was expected to do, taking Miss Cunningham's ice-cold fingers in mine and wishing her happiness. Then I was obliged to turn to Wildred, in whose eyes I saw, or fancied I saw, a malicious light of comprehension and triumphant defiance. But his hand I would not take. "It is hardly necessary to congratulate you," I said haltingly. "You are one of the most fortunate men in the world." "And the most undeserving?" It was he who added the words, as though he had read them in my own mind, and there was a slight, sarcastic, rising inflection of the voice at the end of the sentence, as if he put it to me as a question. Of course, I vouchsafed him no answer, unless he found it in my eyes, which have never been telltales. But in that moment I would have laid down my life could I have wrenched from my memory that episode of his history, the secret of which it mercilessly withheld from me. I have a dim recollection of saying something more or less conventional to Sir Walter and Lady Tressidy, and then, at last, I got away. I had fancied that not to have her face before my eyes, that not to endure the pang of seeing them together, and to escape into the open air, would relieve the tension of my feelings. But it was not so. The moment the door had closed behind me, the agony of the thought that I had seen her, perhaps for the last time, and the poignancy of my regret that I had not been able to put to her one question which rang in my brain, became well-nigh unendurable. I walked rapidly away from the house, telling myself that the best thing for me would be to leave England again at once. I had been a fool to fancy myself homesick, and to come back to this. So far my life had been lived contentedly enough apart from the influence or love of women. What strange weakness of the soul had seized me, that I should thus have yielded without a struggle to a single glance from a pair of violet eyes? Yes, assuredly, the sooner I got away the better. There had been nothing save a restless desire for home to bring me to my native land. There was less than nothing to keep me there. Never to see her again. Never again. I believed that my mind was made up, and yet I think I would have cut off my hand for the chance of one more moment with her, one more glimpse of her face to take away across the sea, even though she neither saw nor spoke to me. I walked aimlessly in the darkness, knowing not and caring not where I went. I heard a clock strike 8, realizing suddenly that I was far from my hotel and that I had wearied myself uselessly. I must write some letters that night, crying off 2 or 3 engagements that I had been foolish enough to make, and explaining that I had been suddenly and unexpectedly called away. As I had walked, I had made up my mind whither I would go. India would be rather good at this time of year, I thought, and I had always promised myself, when I should find the leisure, to make certain explorations. There had also been an idea smoldering in my mind for a year or two that with my knowledge of the language and a proper disguise, it might be possible for me to push my way into the jealously guarded Tibet. Now was the very moment for some such experiments as these. I hailed a cab and drove back to the Savoy, from a distant and more or less, to me, unknown region of London. Try as I might to keep my thoughts from the one absorbing topic by dwelling upon the plans for the future, the effort was useless. Karen's face was before me, and again I heard her words, which might have meant so much or so little. Many things in my life, even my friends sometimes, have come to me too late. As I entered the hotel, my eyes dazzled by the sudden brilliant light, I could hardly for an instant believe that it was not an optical illusion when I saw in the flesh the face which had been haunting me. But it was indeed she. There was no doubting that. People were coming into the Savoy for dinner, now so fashionable a way of passing the deadly dull London Sunday evening, and in a moment I had guessed that she and her party were of the number. I had even an impression of a sentence begun by Lady Tressidy that afternoon, which would doubtless have ended with the information that she and the others were dining at my hotel in the evening, had she not been interrupted and so forgotten as I had done. There had been a dreary drizzle of rain outside, and I was conscious that my long wanderings through muddy streets had rendered me unpresentable. Still, my wish had been granted me. There stood Karen Cunningham, in white from head to foot, a long soft evening cloak, with shining silver threads straying over its snowy surface, hung loosely about her, for she had fastened it at the throat, and I could see a gleam of bare neck, hung with a rope of pearls, and the delicate folds of chiffon belted in with jewels at her girlish waist. Her head was turned aside and slightly bent, a light from above streaming down on her uncovered hair and transforming the copper into gold. Sir Walter and Lady Tressidy were close by, not 6 feet away, and all were evidently waiting for someone, Carson Wildred, no doubt, I bitterly told myself. None of the party had as yet seen me. Sir Walter and his wife were talking very earnestly together, and had perhaps moved a few steps from the young girl that their words might not be overheard by her. I knew that if I were wise, I would at once take myself off without announcing my presence, but a sudden impulse seized and overmastered me. It was a desperate one, doubtless, but nonetheless alluring and powerful because of that. End of chapter 9. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 10 of The House by the Lock by Mrs. C. N. Williamson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 10. If He Had Committed a Crime. Karen stood, as I said, perhaps a couple of yards distant from her friends, and their backs, at the present moment, were more than half turned to her. It would be just possible for me to speak to her without being observed by them, if I were both extraordinarily cautious and lucky. At any moment Wildred, who had perhaps gone to rectify some vexatious mistake about a table, might return. If I meant to take the step at all, there was no time to be lost in doing so. Without giving myself a second for further reflection, and with the blood surging to my temples, I found myself, with a few strides, beside her. Mud-stained boots and trousers were forgotten. I would waste no time in apologizing for my appearance. What she must have thought of my pale and eager face, suddenly bent over her, I do not know. I felt that a great crisis in my life, perhaps in hers as well, had arrived, and my eyes must have shown something of that which stirred so passionately in mind and heart, for she started with a look almost of fear as she saw and recognized me. She uttered no exclamation, however. If she had, Sir Walter and Lady Tressidy would have heard and looked round, and my one chance, so desperately snatched from fate, would have been gone like a bubble that bursts ere it is fairly expanded. Without one spoken word, I made her see that she must come with me, and the quick realization of my power over her, as she laid her hand upon my arm unhesitatingly, thrilled me to the very core of my being. Most women would have refused to come, or at least questioned my sudden appearance and intention, but not so with her. She knew that I had something to say to her which must be said, and it was her will to hear it. She had been pale as a statue of marble as she stood leaning listlessly against the wall in her white dress, but as she moved away with me, life and color came back to her face. I led her down the hall to a small public drawing-room, and not once did she hesitate or look back, unconventional as was the adventure in which she was engaged. Luckily, the place was empty, save for two elderly French women, who gossiped and gabbled with their heads close together on a sofa in a corner.
"What is it? Oh, what is it?" questioned Karen.
"Quick, there will only be a moment, I know, for they will see that I have gone, and will soon find me here." Without any preface I came straight to the asking of the bald, crude question which was in my mind to ask.
"For the sake of our friendship, Miss Cunningham, forgive me, and tell me whether you love Carson Wildred?"
She started and quivered almost as though I had struck her a blow, and her large, frightened eyes studied mine for a long second without answering. Then she said simply,
"No, my friend, I do not love him."
"Yet you have promised to marry him?"
"Yes."
"And you mean to carry out that promise?"
"Yes, unless..."
"Unless what?"
"Something happens to prevent me."
"If you do not love him, something shall prevent. Let me help you. For heaven's sake, let me. Only give me an idea how it can best be done. I ask no more. I will teach you what such a friendship as mine can have the power to do." I hoped to give her courage by the passion and force of my words, but, strangely enough, the bright eagerness died out of her face as I spoke. In some way I had missed saying the thing which might have comforted her. If I had only known! If I had only known!
"You are very kind," she said, gently and sadly. "I am not looking forward to any great degree of happiness in my life, but I dare say, after all, I shall get on as well as most women. I don't think anything will happen to prevent what we were speaking of."
"Why, is it to come so soon, then?" I questioned impetuously.
"In 6 weeks. It was all arranged today,"
with a soft little sigh at the end of her sentence. "Tell me this, are you in any way being forced into the marriage?"
"Not by people, exactly, only by circumstances. I can't tell you any more. Though, believe me, I am grateful for all you mean, and all you would do for friendship's sake."
There seemed a faint ring of stifled bitterness in the last three words, though wherefore it should come I knew not. If she had resented the warmth of my friendship after our brief acquaintance, what would she feel, I dimly wondered, should I forget myself and be coward and fool enough to tell her of my mad love on the very day of her betrothal to another man? With all my strength I held my tongue under control, And heaven knows it was no easy victory with those sweet eyes looking into mine. "Tell me, what could prevent it?" I persisted imploringly. "If you found that he was unworthy, would that..." She half smiled, though without any mirthfulness. "There are so many degrees of unworthiness, aren't there? And I am not clear enough to perfection to believe myself a judge." "If he had committed a crime?" I went desperately on. And the words on my own lips made me start as though with a sudden revelation. I seemed to have assured myself of a fact which had actually taken place, rather than uttered a mere suggestion. The conviction grew within me that if Carson Wildred had not successfully altered his face and each characteristic of his personality, I should at once be able not only to remember, but to prove that my haunting half-recollection was intimately connected with some criminal deed done by him. "Ah, then! But it is wrong to wish that he should have been guilty of any wickedness. I think, Mr. Stanton, that as I have promised to be his wife, we must talk no more of this, you and I. I have always had a horror of disloyalty." "I know," I said, "that I have done an unheard-of thing in thus stealing you away from your friends to ask you questions which only the most intimate friends could claim the right to ask, but..." "Oh!" she cried impulsively. "Somehow you and I have bridged over years. You are good to me. Don't think I will misunderstand. I shall always remember you, and what you would have done for me." "What I shall try yet to do, in spite of all," I amended. "I meant to leave England soon, but now I shall stay."
"Yes, stay," she faintly echoed, "though you must leave me now. I would rather anything than that you were with me when they come to me. I will make them some excuse for having separated myself from them. Only go now, please, go."
As she spoke, outside in the hall we heard voices and footsteps coming nearer. End of chapter 10. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 11 of The House by the Lock by Mrs. C. N. Williamson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 11. Wildred Scores. Karen's face grew paler than before. Throwing up her head with a proud, spirited little gesture, she walked quickly to the door and passed into the hall. I knew that this was to prevent her friends from entering and finding us together, as they must otherwise have done, and there was nothing for me to do, cowardly as this seemed, but obey her and passively submit to the carrying out of her scheme. It had indeed been Sir Walter and Lady Tressidy and Carson Wildred whose voices we had heard.
"Why did you run away? We have been looking for you everywhere and wasting so much time," I heard Lady Tressidy say fretfully.
"I was very tired of standing," the girl promptly returned, "and of waiting, too," with a certain imperiousness in her tone. "I wandered away to fill up the time, till Mr. Wildred should have straightened matters in the dining-room." She had contrived to satisfy their curiosity without telling an actual falsehood, of which I knew instinctively she would greatly dislike making herself guilty. It did not seem to occur to them to enter the drawing-room where she had left me, and when I was sure that they had passed out of sight and hearing, I came forth from the ignominious hiding-place to which her command had condemned me. In the exalted mood which had possession of me, the thought of dinner would have been abhorrent. For the rest of the evening I kept my room, meditating many things, and becoming more and more desirous of learning Carson Wildred's secret, if secret indeed he had. At all events, I still had 6 weeks in which to work, with the hope ever before me of saving Karen Cunningham from the man whom, by her own confession, she did not love, Strange and desperate expedients passed in review before me. How was I to accomplish my object? The man had denied ever having met me in old days, when it had been mentioned to him that I fancied a previous acquaintance had somewhere existed, and if I were to learn anything satisfactory in regard to his antecedents, I felt that it must be from others. He had made himself a name in a certain set in London, there was no doubt of that, and I set myself to find out, step by step, how he had contrived to do it. What was the actual foundation for the reports of his wealth, his smartness, his influence on many sides? On the following day, Monday, I went to my old club, the Wayfarers, which I had not yet troubled with my presence, and picked out a man named Driscoll, who made a business of knowing everybody and everything. Beginning with some conventional talk about the changes in England in general, and London in particular, since I had seen it last, I managed to mention Carson Wildred without appearing to have dragged his name into the conversation for any special purpose of my own. It sprang from some talk about a British Christmas, and I made as humorous a story as I could about my having gone down to the House by the Lock only to miss my friend and my dinner after all. "Wildred can entertain royally if he chooses," said Driscoll. "I've been to dinners he gave at the Savoy and Prince's and Willis's rooms, don't you know, something really quite original, with flowers alone which must have cost a fortune. People come to his entertainments, too. He can get anybody he wants, from the duchesses down to the music-hall favorites, even if he likes to get up a conventional river party with a spread down at that queer old place of his you speak of, the House by the Lock." "It is a queer place indeed," I echoed. "I wonder how he came by it."
"Oh, if the stories are true, in a way as peculiar as the place itself, therefore appropriate. It was owned, I know for a matter of fact, by an Italian whose father was exiled and came over here to live after 48, a chap by the name of Di Tortorelli, belonging to a good family and all that, had the entree everywhere. The son, a nice fellow except that he was weak, loved nothing so well as baccarat. Somehow he and Wildred got acquainted, when Wildred was little known, if at all, in society, and the two played cards on rather a big scale at the house of a mutual friend. Di Tortorelli had bad luck one night, lost a pot of money, and finally, having nothing else left that was worth having, staked the House by the Lock, very dilapidated, and in a shocking state of repair. Well, that's the way Wildred got it, and there are those who do say that after having won almost everything Tortorelli had, Wildred financed him till his marriage with a rich American on the proviso that Tortorelli should get him into the smart set. Those are only Wildred's enemies, of course. For like most men of strong character, he has a few, though on the whole his generosity has made him extremely popular. "Then he knew no one when he first appeared over the social horizon?" I went on questioning. Driscoll laughed. "I never heard of anyone who knew him before the day when he first blazed forth as a social luminary about 3 or 4 years ago. He took a house in town for the season, I remember. It was the Duke of Torquay's, one of the finest in town, and let for a fabulous sum. Then he and Tortorelli gave an entertainment together, somehow securing several royalties, to say nothing of Paderewski and La Belle Otero, and one or two other celebrities, who must each have cost him anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 pounds for the one night. After that, Wildred was made, of course, for the affair was a brilliant success. By the way, that was the first time he ever met the beautiful Miss Cunningham, who had just made a triumphant debut as the beauty of the season. In fact, most people think the most beautiful girl who has been seen since the day when Mrs. Langtree created her first sensation in London. Miss Cunningham was at the party with the Tressidys,
and blasé chap as he was even then, Wildred went down at the first shot from a pair of dark eyes, violet, brown, no one ever yet was sure of their color. Of course, she's a great heiress, but the man must be blind and paralyzed who couldn't fall in love with Karen Cunningham for herself. And however he gets it, Carson Wildred has no lack of money of his own. "How does gossip say he gets it?" I went on to inquire with eagerness, which I concealed as best I could. "Oh, gossip doesn't trouble itself much in that way," Driscoll laughed. "It only concerns itself to eat his dinners, for as a matter of fact, though I can't exactly vouch for it myself, there isn't much secret about the way the money pours in. It's the man's extraordinary luck. He seems to have a lot of relations who are always good-naturedly going off the hooks and leaving Wildred fortunes just when he needs them most. Old fellows in the Antipodes, don't you know, who might really quite as well be dead as not. It's all straight enough, of course, but the funny thing is that if one hears one day that Wildred has come rather a cropper at Newmarket or the Derby or somewhere else, the news within the month is pretty sure to be that another Johnny in Australia or elsewhere has conveniently slipped his cable and left Wildred a cool 50,000 or so at the very least." Hardly had the laughter prompted by his own words died on Driscoll's lips when, to my astonishment, the man of whom we spoke sauntered into the room. He was looking at peace with all the world, and as nearly handsome as it was possible for him to look, the contrast between him and the podgy, elderly gentleman by whom he was accompanied being much to his advantage. "Talking of angels," ejaculated Driscoll beneath his breath, "what do you think of that for a coincidence?" "Is he a member here?" I asked in an equally low voice, for I did not wish Wildred to have the satisfaction of guessing that he had formed the subject of conversation between me and my companion.
"No," Driscoll said, "but he often comes in with old Wigram, who's been a great traveler, you know, and who now goes in no end for dabbling in chemistry. That's Wildred's great fad, and makes the two, who are as different as possible, rather chummy."
As we spoke on, still in somewhat cautious tones, the two newcomers drew nearer to us, greeting several men whom they knew, and finally sat down. The room felt the colder to me for Carson Wildred's presence. Half an hour dragged along, and I was thinking of moving on, when, as I passed Wildred with a slight inclination in return for his, somewhat to my surprise, he followed me.
"How do you do?"
he said, with an attempt at an ingratiating smile.
"Now, if you won't think me rude for the suggestion, I'd be willing to bet you £100 to a fiver that you and Driscoll were doing me the honor of discussing some of my affairs, if not myself, when I happened to look in just now."
Here was a good opening for a conversation unweighted by polite fictions, and I unhesitatingly accepted it.
"Yes," I replied, quietly, turning more fully towards him. "We were talking of you and your affairs." I readily divined that from the look on Driscoll's innocent old mug as I entered. I am remarkably quick at reading other people's faces.
"I have flattered myself that I am the same, when the faces have not been altered almost, if not quite, beyond recognition." I looked full into his curious pale eyes as I gave him this hint, but they did not fall before mine, and his dark, sallow skin could scarcely be paler than its wont. He returned my stare, and was not afraid to show me that my meaning had made itself clearly understood.
"Why speak in riddles, my dear Mr. Stanton?" he asked, shrugging his shoulders a little. "But as we have got upon this subject, suppose we follow it up to the end, bitter or otherwise, and as you may not care to talk all your fellow wayfarers into your inmost confidence, I suggest that we move out of earshot of the mob. Here are a couple of chairs and a table, far from the madding crowd. Shall we sit for 5 minutes or so? Thanks. And won't you let me offer you a cigar? These are not bad ones. A present from the Shahzada last year."
I courteously refused the offer, watching him with some interest as, pretending to be unconscious of or indifferent to my scrutiny, he struck a match and lighted his cigar.
"I have already frankly assured you, Mr. Stanton," he went on, "that I am not aware of having met you before the other night, Christmas Eve, I think it was, at the theater with my very good friend Farnham. But you evidently wish me to see that you still firmly believe I am, mistaken. Am I not stating the case correctly? But it is certainly far from flattering to me that you should have almost completely forgotten me, to say the least."
"I shall remember you again, sooner or later," I murmured.
"I sincerely hope so, if in any way we have come across each other in the past, unknown to me. But I have been so well acquainted with you by reputation for some years, Mr. Stanton, that I would be ready to swear my memory could not have played me false."
I did not reply, save by a slight upward movement of the eyebrows, but I was conscious that he was gazing at me intently.
"You do not like me," he remarked presently, in the same low, monotonous tone of voice which we had employed so far throughout our disjointed conversation. It was my turn to shrug my shoulders. "I should not be apt to select you as a friend."
"I wonder," very slowly and lazily, "whether it be possible that I can in any way, quite inadvertently, have interfered with your plans?"
"Rather say," I broke out imprudently, "that it is possible I may interfere with yours."
He laughed.
"I wonder how."
"In no definite way, unless I should happen suddenly to remember exactly where and how I have met you before. That little accident might slightly hamper your career in general for the future, perhaps."
"You are pleased to be insulting, and yet, somehow, I don't want to take offense from you. I would much prefer to argue you out of your somewhat unreasonable prejudice and mistake. Do you suggest, for instance, that I am now concealing my identity under a disguise?"
So speaking, he raised his hand with a pretense at carelessness, pushing his dark hair from his forehead in such a way as to assure me without doubt that he did not wear a wig.
"The mustache, allow me to give you an ocular demonstration, is equally genuine," he sneered. "I don't sport a false nose, or I should have procured myself a more desirable one, and my teeth," with a disagreeable grin, "are my own. Have I convinced you that I have not tampered with nature's handiwork, such as it is?"
"You might have waited, Mr. Wildred," I returned, "until I had accused you of doing so before trying to prove the contrary. You know the saying, 'He who excuses, accuses himself,' I suppose?"
"I have heard it, though fortunately it does not concern the case. Look here, Mr. Stanton, you and I are sitting here among mutual friends, apparently holding, so far as they can see or hear, an amicable discussion. But the truth is, I have wit enough to understand that what you would like and what you mean is war to the knife. Fortunately for me, I am one of Her Majesty's most peaceable, law-abiding subjects, and always have been so. I have as little to hide in my past as any man can possibly have, less than yourself even, it may be, and therefore I do not fear your prying and can afford to laugh at your impertinence. I will even have my family tree brought out for your benefit if you choose, and will engage to show you the diary which I have kept for years, and where you can see exactly how and where my time has been spent for the last decade or so. anything to please a famous, and therefore privileged, man like yourself. Is it a bargain, Mr. Stanton? Will you accept my data if I provide it for you?" So great an anxiety to disarm the suspicions of a stranger might tend to confirm than strengthen them, I said slowly. "As you will. I see you don't intend to take my overtures of peace in the spirit in which they were offered. Well, you seem fond of proverbs, so here is a Roland for your Oliver. Forewarned is forearmed. You will not have me for a friend. You are indiscreet enough to advise me that you intend to make mischief for me if you can. If you can, mind. My conscience is clear as to my past, and here and now I dare you to do your worst." Leaning his elbow on the table, his head upon his hand, he faced me, looking up sideways with a mocking brilliance in his pale eyes. "It is my turn to give you warning, and it is this. I make a bad enemy. Even had I some black secret, jealously guarded for years, which I haven't, you would never drag it from me. I believe myself to be a cleverer man than you, and if I had chosen the role of villain, I should have been a successful one, there is no doubt. You would not, Mr. Stanton. Had I something which it was vital to my interests to conceal, I should have gone about it in such a way that not the devil himself pitted against me should worm my secret from me. Had I elected to commit a crime, it would not have been until after I was ready with an absolutely infallible alibi. Now, if you are sensible, the very fact that I have made these admissions will prove my innocence to you. It will be a waste of your valuable time if you attempt to stand in my way, in any quarter whatever." He rose lazily. "Good evening, Mr. Stanton," he said in a louder tone, which he made both cordial and impressive, for the benefit of any listening ears. "This has been a most interesting chat with you, one I am not likely soon to forget. I hope it may not be long before I have the pleasure of meeting you again." He had certainly scored. I was obliged, hot with indignation and self-scorn, mentally to confess as much. He had kept his temper, and he had got the better of me. If my time would only come! End of Chapter 11. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 12 of The House by the Lock by Mrs. C. N. Williamson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 12. Karen's Engagement Ring. In the first hour of my anguish after hearing that Karen was lost to me, I had come very near to registering a vow that, voluntarily, I would not see her again. Now, however, since our memorable chance meeting in the hotel, my resolve was different. I determined, on the contrary, that I would see her as often as possible. Even if I had to follow the Tressidys into the country on a pretense of hunting, or some other flimsy pretext of the sort, I would be near her. I had luckily kept my head sufficiently to breathe no word of love to Karen. I had even dwelt with some emphasis upon my friendship, as though to assure her that she need fear no more, need dread no persecution at my hands. I believed that she did not suspect my real feeling for her, and certainly Sir Walter and Lady Tressidy had no reason to fancy anything of the kind. Wildred had suspicions, I was sure, but they could only have been born of quick and jealous intuitions. He could make no charge against me, and it was not likely, I thought, that he would choose deliberately to put such an idea into his fiancée's head, unless I were far less cautious in my behavior than I meant to be. I could not conceal from myself that the talk I had had with the fellow at the Wayfarers
had somewhat discouraged me as to the ultimate success of my efforts to expose him. And as days went on, I found it impossible entirely to shake off the impression made by his words. His personality was disagreeably magnetic to me. I had to acknowledge its power, and in spite of myself, there were moments when I felt daunted by his defiance. Had he not been very sure of himself, he would not have dared to say what he had said. I believed, as firmly as ever, that there was a black spot in his past upon which I could put my finger if only I could place him in my mental gallery of photographs in which his portrait had been so mysteriously blurred or changed. But he and Karen Cunningham would in all probability be man and wife at the end of 6 weeks, and 6 weeks was, after all, but a short space in which to tear the mask from so preternaturally clever a scoundrel. I thought then, and even yet, I trust, that my resolution to save Karen from this man, if I were able to do so, was not all selfishness. Knowing nothing, yet suspecting much with haunting vagueness, it seemed a horrible desecration to me that the beautiful, gentle girl should be given up to Wildred. I had little enough hope for myself with her, whatever might betide, for even had it been possible, under happier circumstances, that she could have learned to care for me, she and her friends would be sure to misunderstand and condemn my motives in working against the man she had promised to marry. Should I have the good fortune to show him to her and those in authority over her as the villain I believed him to be, I could not imagine myself ever attempting to take selfish advantage of his downfall. What I might do, or try to do, I told myself, must be without any hope of future reward. I had persuaded myself that the oftener I could see Karen, and impress upon her the strength and disinterestedness of my friendship, silently assuring her of my unforgotten resolve to help, the better it would be for her. She had said once that she had many acquaintances but no friends, and she had seemed glad to welcome my friendship, so that now I wanted her to see I did not mean to fail her, that, after all, it might not be, as she had thought, too late. At least I succeeded in convincing myself that these were my only motives in calling again within the week on Lady Tressidy. It was Thursday, and the family was to flit away to the country on the following afternoon. I was informed of this by the footman, whose duty it was to tell me that his mistress was superintending her packing at the moment, but would be down almost immediately. Meanwhile, Miss Cunningham was in Lady Tressidy's boudoir, and would see me. I could scarcely believe in my good luck, and in her courage, or good nature. She had been writing at a little davenport by the window, but rose to receive me, and extended her hand. To the other, the left, she had transferred the pen, with the ink still wet, and so it was that, as she greeted me, my eyes fell upon a ring which had not before adorned her finger. It was the third of the left hand, and to my amazement I recognized the magnificent diamond, still in the old setting, worn for so many years by Harvey Farnham. End of chapter 12. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 13 of The House by the Lock by Mrs. C. N. Williamson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 13. Kismet and Miss Cunningham. Had I paused for an instant's reflection, I must have felt it would be impossible for me to take any open notice of the ring. But so great was my surprise at seeing Harvey Farnham's treasured possession on Miss Cunningham's finger that involuntarily I uttered a slight exclamation. Biting her lip, she hastily withdrew the hand, dashing the pen she had been holding with a petulant little gesture onto the desk where she had been writing. "Why do you look so astonished?" she cried, a certain bitterness in her voice, "at seeing me wear the sign of my bondage." She tried to laugh as she spoke, giving an effect of lightness to the words, but the effort was a failure. I would not let her continue to think that she was right in the guess she had made as to my emotion. "It was not wholly that, Miss Cunningham," I returned. "Say, rather, I was surprised at seeing you wear this particular ring." "It is a remarkable one, isn't it? Far too gorgeous and conspicuous to please me, for myself. But Mr. Wildred was anxious for me to have it. I believe it has been in his family a long time, and has been handed down from generation to generation of betrothed brides, happier than myself." The last three words were spoken almost in a whisper, but I heard and understood them as I would have understood the faintest murmur from those lips so dearly loved. Some dim awakening thought, scarcely clear to my own consciousness, stirred in my mind at her strange announcement. I could not resist further questioning. "Did Mr. Wildred tell you that the ring was an heirloom in his family?" "Yes, there is a romance attached to it." She sighed faintly, as though at the death of romance in her own young life. Then, more quickly, "Why, Mr. Stanton, why do you ask me that?" I could not tell her why, but my heart was bounding with a new excitement. "Forgive my curiosity," I said evasively. "I am interested in all that concerns you." She turned from me, ostensibly to arrange her scattered papers on the little davenport, and, relieved of the thraldom of those lovely eyes, I endeavored to collect my scattered thoughts. Somehow I felt that I was on the eve of a discovery which might be of vast importance in both our lives. How had Wildred obtained that ring from Harvey Farnham? Why had he lied about it to Karen? That he was a villain and a schemer, I was sure, though I had had no possible means of proving it. What if this seemingly small matter should put a clue into my hands? So clever a scoundrel should not have committed himself to a lie thus easily disproved, I thought. Only necessary lies were worth the risk for a man of acumen such as his. But even the most crafty of mortals is fallible, I reflected, and liable to make some insignificant mistake, which, like one stone wrongly placed in the foundation of a vast building, renders the whole structure unstable. Possibly Wildred had found a stealthy pleasure in weaving a pretty romance round the ring which he had chosen as the sign of his betrothal, and in weaving it he had forgotten that I, as an acquaintance of Farnham's, might have been conversant with its real history. Or, perhaps, he had not counted upon the fact that Karen might retell the version he had given her to me. I know how greatly Farnham had valued the marvelous diamond in its quaint setting, and I remembered how, only on the night of our last meeting, he had reiterated to me his determination to keep it. It was too small to be removed, save by cutting, he had said, and I had satisfied myself by observation that he had not exaggerated. He must then have gone so far as to have the ring cut from his finger before sailing for America, that he might leave it as a parting pledge of friendship with Carson Wildred. The rich red-gold circlet hung loosely enough, however, on Karen's slim little finger, and a sudden strong desire that she should allow me to look at it caught hold of me. "Would it be asking too much?" I said, "to have the wonderful heirloom in my hand to examine for a moment?" Without a word she slipped the ring off and gave it to me, almost as though it was a relief to feel its absence. In a flash a certain recollection had leaped into my mind. There was an inscription inside, Harvey Farnham had told me. If the ring had been cut, doubtless the words written within would show some trace of the violent treatment to which the band of gold had been subjected, and I wished, for a reason I hardly dared admit to myself, to ascertain if this were the case. I moved towards the window, and, ostensibly catching the light upon the facets of the matchless stone, peeped into the circlet. To my surprise, the words inscribed on the gold were, "Kismet and Miss Cunningham." They were absolutely unbroken, not a letter blurred, and the surface of the ring gave the appearance of having been untouched since first it was fashioned. I was certain that it had not been cut. This being so, how had the ring been removed from the finger of its owner? "You are wondering at the words written inside, aren't you?" Karen asked, coming a little nearer to me. "It does seem extraordinary that they should be there, doesn't it, when you think that the ring was made many years ago, and was not intended for me at all. But Mr. Wildred has explained the mystery, which is a part of the history of the heirloom, and accounts for his being particularly anxious for me to wear it." I, too, could have explained the mystery. I had been told by Farnham that the stone had come from the first diamond mine in which he had been interested. It had been fancifully dubbed Kismet, and the gold mine, which he had lately sold to Carson Wildred, had, as he had informed me that night of our meeting at the theater, rejoiced in the name of the Miss Cunningham. Doubtless the inscription was intended to commemorate the fact that the gold forming the ring had been taken from the one mine, the diamond from the other. But, knowing all this, I was none the less anxious to hear what Karen might have to say. "It does sound an odd coincidence," I remarked. "Will you tell me the story?" I had a very specific object in carrying on this conversation, but as for Karen, I could feel that her part of it was sustained merely for the sake of keeping me from treading upon more dangerous ground. Yet despite this nervous anxiety of hers, I could see, or I flattered myself, that she was vaguely surprised and piqued that I should be willing to discuss so trifling a subject during the fleeting moments before Lady Tressidy might be expected to appear. "You may hear the little romance if you like," the girl said, a faint wistfulness in her sweet voice. 60 or 70 years ago, Mr. Wildred tells me, a very dashing ancestor of his fell in love with a Miss Cunningham. That is not a very uncommon name, you know. He was penniless, and she an heiress. Her father would have nothing to do with him, and told him he need not hope to win his daughter unless, within a year, he could afford to buy her the finest diamond betrothal ring ever seen in the country. The lover vowed it was kismet that he should marry Miss Cunningham, and swore to return and claim her by slipping such a ring on her finger, exactly 12 months from the day he was sent away. He had the most extraordinary adventures in search of a fortune, always ending in failure, until the last month of the appointed time. He was in India, working in the diamond mines, when one day he found this very stone. He sailed at once for England, had the ring made, and the words you see engraved inside. As he had said, he arrived on the very day appointed, but only to find the girl coming out from church after her marriage with another man. He threw the ring at her feet and flung himself away. But at her death it was sent back to him again, and though he never married, he gave it to his brother's bride on her wedding day. Since then it has remained in the Wildred family. I could have laughed aloud at this sentimental tale invented by the man whom I now believed had somehow contrived to steal the jewel, to account for the commonplace words it would have been difficult to erase. Had I laughed, however, my laughter would have been bitter indeed, ending in an even increased desire to save from him and his trickery the girl I loved. It is needless to say that I did not laugh, but something of what was in my mind must have been visible on my face, for Karen, as she finished her story, looked up at me searchingly. "What are you hiding from me, Mr. Stanton?" she anxiously questioned. "It is about the ring, and if you are my friend, as you say, you will not keep it a secret from me." "It is about the ring, Miss Cunningham," I replied impulsively. "I can't tell you all, for the facts have hardly yet grouped themselves in my own brain. But if they have such bearing upon your happiness as I have some reason to think, you shall know them as soon as I can make them clear to you. Will you trust me, meanwhile? Will you try to remember that I am striving to collect facts which may help to release you from the necessity for an unworthy marriage? Never for one moment since I saw you last have I let slip the hope of saving you from what you confessed must be a blighted future. Now, I may be mistaken, but I believe that I begin to see my way." She looked at the ring, which I had returned to her, with startled, dilating eyes. "Something connected with this?" she murmured. "Yes, it is as if I had placed my eye to that little circlet, looking through it as through a spyglass towards my goal. I shall work after this, Miss Cunningham, as I could not work before, because I have now a fixed starting point. It may be an intricate tangle that I shall have to unravel. It may be a tedious task, yet..." "There are only 6 weeks, less than 6 weeks to do it in," she murmured, but a faint color had sprung to her cheeks, a light of hope to her eyes. "Is it not possible," I begged, "if I find myself near success, yet stopped temporarily midway by some unforeseeable obstacle, that you can delay your marriage? Let me have that to hope for. It will help me to win." She shook her head sadly, and the rose flush died. "It is useless to think of it," she said. "You may imagine, since I have confessed so much to you, that it was not my plan to name such an early date. It was Mr. Wildred who suggested it. Indeed, he insisted, and unfortunately he is in a position to insist." "Has nothing changed since we met at the Savoy?" I hurriedly asked. "Can't you explain to me the power which you admitted then that this man holds over you?" "No, nothing is changed, Mr. Stanton. The reason that I cannot explain is a part of his power, if you like to call it that." "Heaven knows I do not like it," I exclaimed almost savagely. And as the words fell from my lips, Lady Tressidy entered the room. She had finished superintending her packing, and the sight of her was a sudden sharp reminder that next day she would take Karen away. End of chapter 13. Recording by Roger Moline.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.